Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the A24 project here on the Nerd Party. On today's episode, we're taking a look at Life After Beth and The Captive. I'm Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yes, I'm not too bad. This is an interesting episode. As usual, we've kind of got up here. It seems that we've kind of got to a very interesting kind of period in the early A24 years in terms of the movie choices that they've gone with.
Yeah, no, these two are definitely sort of opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of content and tone. And I was thinking, this is our episode 6, but this is our last episode of 2018. We're actually only around about the sort of August to December 2014 stage of the A24 project. So we've got a little bit of time. We've got a wee while before we manage to catch up and get on an even keel. But we're going to talk about these two films in a couple of minutes. But as always, with the A24 project, we've got a small section called the A24 Hour News. And on this week's news, the Oscar race is continuing to heat up quite nicely for certain titles. I think Ethan Hawke is looking good for an Oscar nomination at this point, as he's also been picked as Best Actor at the Chicago Film Critics, the LA Film Critics, and he's also featuring in the Critics' Choice Awards as well. But it's not only him who's looking for a nomination. Toni Collette is also picking up awards. She won at the Chicago Film Critics and was runner-up in the LA Film Critics. They had a winner and a runner-up section. But also, Elsie Fisher from 8th Grade is looking like a potential wild card or black horse, or one of those phrases, for the Oscar nomination, because she managed to pick up a Best Actress in the Drama category nomination at the Golden Globes. So I think there's normally, certainly when it comes to the Oscars, I've always found there's definitely four locks for the category, and then certainly with the acting categories, there can sometimes be a wild card. So what do you think, Lee? Do you think that one of these two choices might be able to sneak it in to the Oscars?
I think with Elsie Fisher, it almost reminds me of Saoirse Ronan in Atonement, that sort of young star. There always seems to be someone, I think, I forget the name of the young girl that was in Little Miss Sunshine as well. There does seem to be a bit of a trend of young girls kind of breaking into sort of Oscar nomination cycles. So, I mean, the problem is that I'm merely speculating on trends as opposed to actually having seen the movie and being able to make some sort of professional attempt to say, well, she was fantastic in this, maybe not as good as such and such another film, but I'm only trying to go on trends here. And I think it's very much possible, but by the time the nominations come in, by the time the Oscars happen, we will still be no closer to actually having seen 8th Grade. So if she even wins the award, we can't even say it was just or unjust. We merely can only go on other people that have seen it over the past year.
I know, but I mean, it reminds me of was it Keisha Castle Hughes for Whale Rider all those years ago? I mean, they've got no problem with nominating young actresses if they think they don't. I mean, we had Anna Paquin one for the Piano. There's been several, but she could sneak in again. Catalina Sandino Marino for Maria Full of Grace, that was something that came out of left field, in 2004. It picked up a few small awards, but people weren't really talking about her until suddenly it came up on the nomination. So there is a chance. I personally would love to see Toni Collette nominated. I think it's my favourite female performance, but she does have that stigma of being in a horror film. I think the last time that someone was nominated for sort of science fiction / horror was Sigourney Weaver back for Aliens in around about 1986. There was The Babadook, Essie Davis, in 2014, I thought she gave a magnificent performance in that film, but it wasn't really recognised because, again, it was in the horror genre. So I guess we'll have to see. They're picking up the independent awards, but we'll have to see if they can break through into the mainstream. But do you think Ethan Hawke is a lock at this moment in time?
I think he's definitely a lock. I mean, this is the time of year, even though it's early December, I still feel that there's a few weeks before people can really make these kind of judgments. But First Reform seems to be popping up on a lot of critics' top lists and winning sort of awards here and there. I think it's got to be a lock at this stage, but you can never really tell with the Academy how many of them have actually seen, you know, their voting public, how many of them have actually seen First Reformed, as opposed to sort of maybe the indie critics and so on in places like New York and LA that have seen the film and believe it to be one of the best or some of the best performances as well of the year. It's hard to know with such a big pool of voters whether First Reformed has made the breakthrough.
Well, I'm pretty sure that A24 will be, you know, campaigning hard and doing all the right things and getting these screenings in LA and stuff in order to make sure that everyone gets a fair chance to see it. You know, the A24 are on the top of their game at the moment. They're not going to do a solo and accidentally forget to submit the application for Best Original Score, which is what's happened apparently. I've read this today that basically they missed the deadline by a couple of days and it's been disqualified. So someone at Disney is probably getting fired at this point in time because they've missed out, because let's face it, it's probably their only chance to get an Oscar nomination for Solo, because it may potentially maybe visual effects, but otherwise I can't really see much happening for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even really remember anything from that score as well. I know John Williams did a bit of a Heroes theme, but I mean, I genuinely can't remember anything from that score. And I mean, there's been plenty of good ones this year to pick from. So I think, you know, even if it had been submitted, I think it's a long shot that it'd even have been nominated. So I feel like someone not submitting the form has actually done a good thing for the environment and clearly learned a lesson from First Reformed. So it's all kind of synergy. They're all working from each other.
Absolutely. And the other bit of news this week is, it's been quite a quiet week beyond the sort of Oscar nominations, but there has been news that A24 have picked up the North American distribution rights for a film called The Souvenir, which is due to get its world premiere at Sundance. Now, this has been directed by Joanna Hogg, who maybe isn't really known in the States, but she's an independent filmmaker working in the UK. She did a film called Archipelago, and also Exhibition, that starred Tom Hiddleston, sort of in between his sort of just getting famous for Thor sort of phase and, you know, becoming a huge star. So, and apparently this film is executive produced by Martin Scorsese, of all people, who saw Archipelago and basically cold-called Joanna out of the blue and asked what she wanted to do next, and this was the film. Have you heard of this one yet, Lee?
No, I'm not too familiar with it. I'm already secretly hoping. I know today, as of our podcast recording, they've announced that Sundance London is coming back again. So this could be potentially one that if me and you are down there, we might be able to catch, no doubt, a year before it gets released here in the UK.
I think you will once I tell you the description of it. So it stars Honor Swinton-Byrne alongside Tom Burke and Tilda Swinton in the story of a quiet film student who finds her artistic voice while navigating a turbulent courtship with a charismatic but untrustworthy man. The youngster defies her protective mother and concerned friends as she slips deeper and deeper into an intense, emotionally fraught relationship which comes dangerously close to destroying her dreams.
I'm sold.
You're sold. And yes, as you probably can guess, the name Honor Swinton-Byrne is indeed Tilda Swinton's daughter, with her, well, I think it's husband, John Byrne, but there's a strange relationship between them. There's like another man in the equation. It's a whole convoluted affair, but apparently it works for them all, so we'll leave them to it. But it does sound good, and it's going to be exciting to see. I mean, if she gets any of the talent that she has from her mother, then Honor Swinton-Byrne could be potentially a bright new star in the Hollywood scene. So it'll be interesting to see that one when it comes. So yeah, it'll debut at Sundance, potentially at Sundance London as well. And then we'll probably find, yeah, as you say, potentially a US release later on in the year, followed by the UK about a year afterwards. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, but we won't hold our breath for an imminent release on that one, shall we say. Otherwise, it would be damaging for our health.
Yeah.
Okay, so first film we're looking at on this week's episode is Life After Beth, which was released in the US in August 2014 and then also came to the UK later on in 2014. I'd say it's very similar to Shaun of the Dead in that the film fits into the rom-zom-com genre and that on paper it plays out like a romantic comedy where a boy attempts to win back the girl that he lost, albeit that the girl he lost her life and has returned as a zombie. Now, this film was written and directed by Jeff Bena, who is the writer of I Heart Huckabees. He co-wrote that with David O. Russell, and also The Little Hours, which was released a couple of years ago, also starring Aubrey Plaza. And I think it was a film that screened at the Edinburgh International Film Festival, but I'm not sure if it ever really got a full release in the UK. And this film stars...
I think it went straight to DVD here.
Yeah. And this film stars Dan Dehane, Aubrey Plaza, John C. Reilly, Anna Kendrick. And so, Lee, what were your first impressions on the film when you heard about it and then on your first initial viewing? And did you see it in the cinema, or was it one that you had to find it on home video or streaming, as they say?
I caught this one at the cinema, actually. I'm a huge Aubrey Plaza fan. I mean, this was sort of at the peak of something like Parks and Recreation. So the idea of Aubrey Plaza in a, you know, undead romantic sort of comedy was something that was a bit of an easy sell for me. And I think the problem that I had with this movie when I went to see it was I enjoyed the first part of the movie, much like Little Hours. It's like, this is an interesting premise. It's quite funny. I like the talent involved. But it kind of wears out its welcome relatively quickly. And I just found myself becoming a bit bored with it. It was, you know, it just didn't have enough steam in it for... I mean, the film is only 90 minutes, but the second half of the movie really feels like it's just struggling to kind of keep up. And the more Aubrey Plaza becomes sort of a creature of the undead, the less funny it gets. She becomes someone that is just like drooling and kind of like becoming a bit moody, and it just doesn't play to perhaps her strengths. She, you know, she's fully committed, but just the material in that second half just isn't as good. And I kind of sort of checked out when I viewed it at the cinema at the time, and then when I rewatched it again recently for this project.
Yeah, no, I think I'm on the same page as you on this one, in that I think I saw it on DVD or I think for the first time. I don't think I caught it at the cinema. It wasn't one that I was initially going out to see. I think when I first saw it, I don't think I'd seen Parks and Rec, so I wasn't really aware of Aubrey Plaza beyond Scott Pilgrim, I think, at that point in time. So it wasn't one that I was rushing out to see, but I did catch it eventually on DVD, probably through Love Film or something like that. Just one of those ones that, okay, I'll just put it on my list and they'll send it through. And then, you know, that was a great thing about Love Film, that you could prioritise some films, but otherwise you just get sent what they had available. And so you'd be, oh, okay, I'll just put that on. Great. And I didn't really have any huge feelings towards it. I think, like you say, it's almost like a one joke film. You know, it's a great setup, a great premise, but beyond sort of like a great half hour sort of sketch or comedy program, but beyond that, it just doesn't really have, like you say, the life in it to drag it to the finish line. You know, it's certainly a slow shuffling zombie rather than one of these modern sprinting zombies that can, you know, keep up with the pace of the jokes and stuff like that. It's got the great setup of, you know, he loses his girlfriend in an accident, she gets bit by a snake and she dies, and he's distraught losing her, and you know, gets a second chance when it turns out that the Aubrey Plaza's parents are hiding her away for this miraculous resurrection, although it slowly turns out that there's a lot of people coming back from the dead to turn into zombies. And, you know, there's a great idea of, you know, what do you do when you've got the second chance, and the comedy of this sort of mismatched couple, although as he starts going further, he actually realises that he actually didn't really like her as much, and he's then trying to break off a relationship with a zombie, and he's also trying to hook up with Anna Kendrick's character as well. And I don't know if it was just the material wasn't great, or if it was Dan Dehane himself, who I'm not really a huge fan of. I thought he was great in Chronicle, but everything else I've seen him in since, such as Valerian, which was a terrible film, and I thought he was awful in it. And I was very surprised that the most charismatic presence in that film actually turned out to be Cara Delevingne, who's similarly one of the most awful things about Suicide Squad. So, but I mean, there was some good elements to it. I thought Aubrey Plaza, as you say, very committed performance. I thought John C. Reilly was great as the overprotective father, just, you know, trying to do what was best for his daughter, even if it meant sort of like almost sort of sacrificing himself and the mother who loses a hand, whatever, trying to feed their zombie daughter and stuff like this. But yeah, no, for me it was just something that sort of carried on far too long and just ran out of steam towards the end. I think you're right.
I think the elements that you're talking about there with sort of John C. Reilly and his mother as well, like those were quite funny at the beginning. Like, how do you, like, when you're kind of talking out the plot, you can see why someone would go, yeah, this sounds like really funny, really interesting. Like, we could easily make a bit of a comedy from this, but it works. And sort of, you can imagine that 22 minute, 30 minute kind of comedy thing. Like, what happens when you discover your daughter is a person of the undead, and sort of the comedy hijinks was like, yeah, stay in. Why don't you stay in? You know, oh, we're going to go for a hike. Well, why don't you wait till nightfall and then you're watching a movie. Oh, come on, let's just stay and watch this. Like, there's very much elements of humor in there. You know, John C. Reilly is so good, and Molly Shannon as the mother, they are a good pairing. But like, even that kind of towards the end, as you say, sort of like the hand gets bitten off, and then there's like so many other people coming back from the dead, it just becomes kind of tiring by that point. Even like the best part of the movie with this family dynamic just becomes a bit tired by the end, and nothing really kind of further to really be said about it.
Yeah, no, I think the problem is, I don't know how the sort of genesis of the film came about, but it sounds and has a concept for a perfect, really good sort of 10 to 15 minute sort of short film about what you do in that situation. And it almost feels like a film where, and this is sort of no disrespect to the writer director, but it feels like one of those situations where you have a title, a great title, you know, Life After Beth. It's like Life After Death, but, you know, it's a girl. And it's like, you've got a title and then you come up with a film to fit it, if you know what I mean. It's sort of, it's like you've, what's that phrase about, you know, they're running before they can walk, in terms of they've got this title, let's build a film around it, rather than the other way of coming up with this like, great idea. It probably isn't the way, it's the way it kind of seems to come across with me, in that there's not really the material to sustain the film over the, I mean, and there's a short running time, it's under 90 minutes, but it just doesn't have the life in it in order to push it over to sustain that running time, unfortunately. And yeah, I mean, it's got great performances in it, it's got some funny moments, but overall it's just a, feels like a slightly wasted opportunity, don't you?
Yeah, and I mean, Aubrey Plaza making her sort of second appearance, she was in her first movie and first episode, In the Mind of Charles Swan the Third. You know, she is a great comedic actor, but I've often found with Aubrey Plaza, it depends on sort of the role she's given. Like, she is always someone to be, you know, praised with, and she always kind of cracks me up. I really like her kind of cynicism, but like in this, she's fine, especially in that beginning part where she's really mostly human. But then you get movies like, say, Dirty Grandpa, where she's reduced to sort of twerking and sort of a bit of a slutty character. But then you get things like Safety Not Guaranteed by Rian Johnson, Ingrid Goes West, which was a real highlight of 2017 for me, and Parks and Recreation. She is fantastic in it, but she just always seems to have sometimes a bit of a mixed opportunity in terms of the work that presents herself. Sometimes she just doesn't seem to pick the right work. And I mean, I've never seen Legion, so I can't even really comment on what she's like in that. And An Evening with Beverly Luff Lynn was also at kind of Sundance London last year. Again, that seemed to have a one night screening here in the UK, and then quickly went on to DVD. I haven't had a chance to watch that one either, but I'd like to kind of, you know, even Little Hours, she was really good in that, but again, it was a movie that sort of outstayed its welcome quite quickly. I would just love to see her getting better roles, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ingrid Goes West was a fantastic role for her, and again, in a sort of small independent film, which I really wish had found a bigger audience, because it has some really sort of really juicy life lessons, you know, messages around this preoccupation with Instagram and social media and stuff, and how it can affect your life and stuff like that. So it's a film which probably, I think, I can't remember if you reviewed it on the show or not, but it was like one that should be shown in schools to teenagers and stuff, and go, this is the effect that, you know, just preoccupation with social media can have on your life, so be careful with it. So, but I think, yeah, I think there's a point coming where she will get the role that really sort of pushes her into the mainstream, because she does deserve it. I mean, her comic timing is excellent, as you say, on Parks and Rec, and she's just needing to find that one role that Well, potentially. I mean, safety not guaranteed as well. She was very good in that. I've heard good things about Legion. I've heard that she's very good in that as well. Looking at her upcoming projects, apparently she's in the Child's Play remake, reboot, or whatever that is. So I don't think that breakout role is coming in the near future. But I guess we'll see. But I mean, what did you make of the... There's a thing in the all zombie movies where they desire brains and they need to feed and stuff like that. But this one took a slightly different tact in that it also basically decided that since zombies are going on their primary motor functions, that they need to eat and sustain themselves, but also their other needs, shall we say, and that she becomes quite forceful with her boyfriend in wanting to have sex. And he's basically trying to say no and trying to let her down gently in the fact that, you know, it's not the right time. It's just basically that he doesn't want to have sex with a dead body. So how did you think that they handled that bit? Because that was one of the more interesting parts of the film for me.
I thought it was okay. It was very much kind of fitting in with the tone that in the beginning that, you know, she's resurrected. Oh my God, I can't believe this girl is back. And, you know, it's like, you know, makeup kind of that we so often have. If we've had a quibble, you always seem to kiss a bit stronger after it. And I mean, like, they're all there kissing away and having a good fondle in the beginning. But then it sort of continues to sort of escalate up and up and up. And again, it's another one of those kind of the parts of the movie where it's just like, it was kind of funny and relatively interesting in the beginning on these couple reunited, they're a bit horny. And then into this, it's like, okay, yeah, come up with something new and innovative. And again, it just falls a bit flat. Even the same with the jazz. You know, this zombies seem to almost love hearing sort of soft jazz. And it's like, oh, that's quite funny in the beginning. And then it keeps going and going until the end of the movie. And I just really felt, again, they really kind of kicked the arse out of that one as well.
Yeah, I think the problem is, the main problem with this film, which is something that on Filibuster recently we talked about Anna and the Apocalypse and how it managed to get the sort of tone right, similar to Shaun of the Dead, where the first sort of half is comedy, then you've got the comedy action, but then it manages to ring in the emotion and stuff where the true horror of the situation, the stakes are raised and you feel for the characters as they go through this when they have to lose loved ones and stuff like that. And this is where I think the film let itself down, in that it was still trying to play it too comedically, where, you know, the mum is basically chopped off her own hand to feed her zombie daughter and stuff like that, and you don't get the payoff from John C. Reilly's character going and stuff like that. And that's what I was missing, the sort of emotional stakes of, and also, you know, with other families, you know, having their dead relatives return to them and stuff like that. I thought it could have been played a bit more straighter, I think, and less comedic and stuff like that, in order to have the desired effect.
Even when, like, they bring back, like, grandparents from the dead, and you're like, oh, it's like, oh, here we go, we're into the third act, something's going to be a bit different here. Then it kind of really doesn't even do much with that. It kind of has a good funny gag, and it doesn't outstay its welcome, that idea, but then it kind of goes back to sort of the relationship again, and then they've now got Beth with a kitchen sink or whatever on her back and a washing machine, and it's like, okay, we're back to kind of this again. It just never seems to go anywhere exciting.
Yeah, no, and I think it's one that was probably best off to have a sort of double tap to the head. And, you know, Life After Beth, you know, it's not you, it's us. It's something that we're going through. We're just not that into you, I think, is the fairest way to sum up our feelings on that one. So moving on, our second film is a film called The Captive, and it was released in the US in December 2014 following its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival back in May 2014. And as far as I'm aware, it's a film which never actually got a UK release and was quite hard to track down for viewing for this little project of ours. Luckily, it came onto Netflix at the beginning of December, so I was able to catch it then. Now, this film is written and directed by Atom Egoyan, who people maybe know from films such as like Where the Truth Lies and The Devil's Knot. And it's a film where Ryan Reynolds and Muriel Enos play the parents of a young girl called Cassandra who is abducted from the back of his truck following a ice skating practice while he stops off to get pie for their celebratory meal. And the film follows the family as they live with the trauma of how the daughter's been disappeared and basically is pulled into a paedophile ring. And it sort of follows the family, but also the police who are in charge of the investigation in order to try and get her back. And so it stars Ryan Reynolds, and it also stars Rosario Dawson, Scott Speedman, Kevin Durand, and Bruce Greenwood as well. Now, Lee, what were your first thoughts of the film, and how did you find out about the film? Was it through this project, or had you, were you aware of it before?
I wasn't familiar with it. I mean, kind of a, some boring behind the scenes information for people. So I made a spreadsheet kind of a few months ago, like, right, you can find this A24 movie here, this one there. I mean, it's not like in America where we have it all under one library app. So I had this one originally on Amazon Prime ages for on my wait list. And then it disappeared from Amazon about 2 weeks ago and now moved on to Netflix. So it finally came off my watch list this week and I watched it. And it really, I thought, you know, if you thought we were kind of a bit, yeah, a bit negative or down on Life After Beth, which is fine enough, really. This, I think, is the worst movie of the A24 series so far. I mean, there's some interesting ideas that are played with time and cutting and editing. But otherwise, I thought this was like a, basically a Lifetime TV movie. I mean, we talked about Life After Beth overstaying its welcome, and at nearly 2 hours, this movie felt like it was just painfully long to watch. It was just really uninspired. I mean, I think they've cast most of kind of Canada's acting talent appeared in this movie. And I mean, the only positive is this is the first appearance of Pi in the A24 series. I mean, we'll even get a better Pi scene and a ghost story in a few episodes to come. But yeah, I just thought this was really disappointing. It was just Lifetime TV worthy drama and just really uninspired. I didn't like it at all, to be honest. And I thought the paedophile villain that we had was really almost a cliche paedophile. I mean, you almost felt like you had the twirling mustache quality with this one. A real mess, to be honest. I wish someone had kidnapped this movie instead, to be honest. Did you think any better of it?
I can't say that I did, to be honest. I had not heard of this film before the project. For a while, until you sort of made up the spreadsheet, I thought we were watching Captive, which starred Kate Mara and David Oyelowo, which came out a couple of years ago as well. But no, it was not that film. It was this film. So I was nearly about to watch the wrong film. Maybe I should have watched the wrong film. It might have been better. Who knows? But yeah, I think the things that you said, that there were slightly interesting uses of cutting and editing and time, I thought they were all wrong for this film. Now, the film scenes take place back when Cassandra, the abducted girl, is 9 years old. So you've got scenes in that bit. You've got scenes in the present day where she is 18 years old and is still held captive in this basement of this paedophile and is basically used to groom new children on the internet. And then there's also other scenes from various points in the investigation. However, none of this is ever really signposted in terms of dates or times. You basically have to try and piece it together by looking at Rosario Dawson's haircut. Now, Ryan Reynolds has a beard in this film, and, you know, it's action stars and comedy stars, you know, sometimes have beards in order to showcase that they're doing a more dramatic, serious movie. But I half expected him to have a beard in some scenes and be clean shaven in other scenes in order to be help differentiate the time. It might have actually helped, because at points I had no idea where in the investigation they were supposed to be. You know, Rosario Dawson is introduced at one point as the lead investigator, and then Scott Speedman is another investigator who says to someone that it's basically she's gone missing and he's now tracking her disappearance, and you're like, what? Okay. And yeah, no, that whole sort of thing just made it a total mess for me in terms of where we're supposed to be in the storyline. You know, that kind of thing can work if it had started with, you know, she's gone for 9 years already, and then they slowly piece things together using flashbacks and stuff like that. But to basically start at the end and then work back to the beginning, but then jump forward a middle bit and then back again, it just did not work for me, and I was completely confused at times as to where in the story we were meant to be. And there was entire plot threads. It was like the whole Bruce Greenwood thing about him being the paedophile's boss, but he was linked, he'd created a charity fundraiser for this sort of thing, and he was being investigated about the disappearance of Rosario Dawson, and you're like, well, is he involved? What does he know? We don't know. It was never really resolved. I have no idea what happened there. And like I say, it's such a slow film. It takes its time with everything, but then in the last 10 minutes feels the need to wrap everything up really, really quickly, to the point where you didn't even get a full resolution on Rosario Dawson's character. She's in a van somewhere. Is she alive? I don't know. You couldn't really tell. I couldn't tell if she was opening her eyes at the end or not. Did she survive? We don't know. And it's just like, okay. And yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, no, I think, yeah, definitely one of the worst that we've watched so far.
Is this the second movie that Rosario Dawson has been in where her hair is a sort of plot point to tell you a twist or something that's going on?
I can't remember what's the other one.
Truce. Trance. The Danny Boyle movie.
And I loved that film. And I, yeah, indeed, yeah, it flips between where you're meant to be in the storyline. But that one for me worked. I thought it was great. I loved the performances in that one. So that was a good film and I'm happy with that. But yeah, this one was just a bit of a mess. I mean, it did have some decent performances in it. I thought Ryan Reynolds was pretty good, but I mean, the rest of it was just a bit of a washout, to be honest.
Yeah, when I said that I kind of liked some of the elements, like the editing and stuff, like I kind of see that in the respect of, like, I gave this movie like 1 out of 5 on Letterboxd, but I'm trying to be almost a bit positive in the respect that, yeah, it was a little different. You know, it wasn't sort of linear. They kind of had this kind of jumbled idea, which, did it work? Not really. Was it interesting? Not really. Did it make this movie somewhat a little bit watchable and made me engage with it a bit? Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, like, you have this basic whiteout in Canada, you know, Ryan Reynolds that never looks like he's aged at all in this movie. And it's just like the giveaways that there's been a time change are so difficult to follow, that if with a movie of this quality where you're really not into it and you're probably thinking about other things, it becomes one of those ones where you're like, oh, wait, what's going on here? And you kind of caught on to the idea that there's time changes going on, probably 3 or 4 cycles later than you probably would if you were in the cinema and you had your eyes, like, wide open watching it.
Yeah, there's so many elements of this film which don't really seem to make sense or add up. And the mother character is working in this hotel and she keeps finding things in the rooms which are basically screaming out, your daughter is still alive, but for some reason doesn't decide to go to the police, doesn't tell her ex-husband, estranged husband, about it either. You know, she's finding baby teeth, you know, she's finding ice skating trophies and things like that. Oh, I'm just going to keep this information to myself and not get the police to go, oh, actually, maybe she's alive, we should actually, you know, increase the search for her and stuff like this. And yeah, and the whole sort of paedophile subplot about there being this ring and stuff like that, you know, one person is captured and you never think to interview the one person who visits him in prison. I mean, come on. I mean, there's just so many logic gaps in the film. And it's really strange because, you know, Adam McGoyan, he did a film, you know, Where the Truth Lies back in 2005, which I thought was a really great film. It's another sort of slight mystery to it. Again, this film is sort of billed as a mystery, but it's clear from the opening scene what's happened to the girl and who the abductor is and stuff like that. So there was no real mystery on it. It was just, how long of my life am I going to waste to find out how this gets resolved? It was the only thing.
That's the one thing that makes you feel a bit odd watching the movies. You're like, oh yeah, like that's clearly the kidnapper, like within the first few minutes. And then you're kind of thinking, like, well, what's the actual mystery, the plot, or the surprise of the movie? Like, we kind of know where everything is. It's just like, how long is it going to take us to get to the point where there's people being reunited? It's just, it's genuinely terrible. And I can only wonder why A24 shelled out the money for this movie. It's definitely an odd one. It doesn't seem to really kind of fit in with even something like Life After Beth. It kind of fits in with the vibe of young, exciting talent and, you know, something a bit different, a bit quirky, something that's interesting to market. This is just really naff.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure why they went with this one. But, I mean, the director has, you know, promise, you know, like you say, Where the Truth Lies was great. It was about a young journalist sort of trying to discover the truth between an incident which broke up a showbiz team. Similar to sort of like a Martin and Lewis type of team, where it was, but it's got Kevin Bacon and Colin Firth in it, and it's a great film and great performances from them all. And but this one just doesn't, it just all doesn't add up, unfortunately. And yeah, it's a huge wasted opportunity. I mean, there's good talent in this, but why they've chosen to do this particular film again? Maybe on paper the script maybe was in a different format. Maybe it played out differently in the original script and he's decided to go in and change things around in the edit to make it a bit more interesting, but it just doesn't work at all. And yeah, it's, I think the problem is, like you say, you know, where you start off where the mystery is already solved. The only time that works for me is Columbo. And that, you know, you've got the, you know, he knows, everyone knows who it is. Even Columbo knows it's just, when are they going to make a mistake when, so Columbo just comes back in with just one more thing and then exposes the whole thing that he knew the whole time. Unfortunately, you don't have anyone on the police force capable of doing that. You know, they've been doing this investigation for 8 years, and in the end it's, you know, a chance conversation that Ryan Reynolds overhears that basically solves the whole thing. You know, if it had been more of a standard thriller where it was Ryan Reynolds doing his investigations versus the police and the sort of butting heads of that, there's a little bit of that, but not enough to create any real sort of tension. If it had been that, I think the film could have worked. But for some reason, they went with the choices they have, and for me, the choices were all wrong.
Absolutely. But hey, it's an appropriate Christmas movie. It's in the snow, so there's that. So if you're watching along at home, it's kind of, you've chosen perhaps a terrible movie, but maybe a slightly tenuous and fitting one.
Yes, and actually we're going to have another opportunity to discuss Adam Egoyan's work, because he also has directed Remember, which will be coming up in a future episode, starring Christopher Plummer. So I guess we'll have to see if that one is any better than this one.
Yes, we can. It wouldn't be difficult, to be honest.
No. But so, yeah, we've reached the end of the year and a natural low point, I guess. But, you know, when you are reviewing a back catalogue, you know, not every film is going to be a Moonlight, is it? Or an Under the Skin. You know, they're not always going to get it right. And, you know, they are a distribution company. They have, you know, they've got slots to fill. They want to do it. But, you know, they will have seen something in this film when it was originally screened, although apparently it was booed on release at Cannes, not because I guess it was controversial in any way, but just because it was a bad film, rather than being controversial or anything, it was just a bad film. But hopefully we'll have much more to cheer in the new year when we return, and our next episode is going to be looking at Tusk and Say When, or if you're in the US, Laggies, I believe it was called. So again, two films which are very different to the two films we've watched this episode, but also very different to each other as well. So we're going to be back in the new year. We'll be taking Christmas and the new year off, but we'll be back sort of around the first week of January with the next episode. But we just wanted to thank everyone for listening so far, and also for leaving reviews on iTunes. We've had 17 five-star reviews so far and some lovely comments. And what we'll be doing is on the 16th, so actually by the time this episode comes out, we'll have drawn the winner, and we'll be announcing the winner on Twitter and all the social media channels as to who has won the A24 film of their choice, and A Great Girl's on Top Tea as well. So keep an eye on social media for that. But Lee, any final thoughts on this week's episodes?
I look forward to the next episode. So Laggies is an interesting one, and Tusk is going to be a first time watch for me as well. So I'm really looking forward to the new year and new movies and powering on.
Absolutely, and I think next episode will be quite unique in that Tusk will be the only film, as far as I'm aware, on the A24 project, which will be based on a Gumtree ad. So we do have that to look forward to. So we hope that everyone has a great Christmas and a great New Year. Hopefully you get some nice presents from Santa in the form of A24 films and merchandise under the tree. But we'll see you in the New Year. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.